Dr. John E. Grawley, Associate Professor of Practical Theology at Biblical Theological Seminary.
I'm going to give this in the form of a paper, and so I'll be reading most of it, making some side comments, and if there are any questions, please stop me. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. David's exclamation is in some ways more meaningful today because of the research that has been done since 1000 BC in human physiology. The physiology of the human brain is still partly mystery. I might say a great part mystery. And the study is in its infant stage. What has been discovered witnesses to the wisdom of the Creator. There have been a number of specials on public television lately, I think of two, that were done on physiology of the human brain. One, a National Geographic special that was very interesting and helpful in some ways. And another one, a NOVA special on what's called Keith Paradise, which is a fascinating presentation talking about some of the recent work in brain physiology. Isaiah asks, whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? The answer is no one. No scientists, design engineers, or any other consultant worked on the project of constructing the brain and its nervous system, and the nervous system. It is God's handiwork. Since this is true, it is necessary to look at brain physiology from the viewpoint of God's purpose and design, rather than viewing man's intricate systems as a product of chance or blind intelligence. In the National Geographic special, Carl Sagan said that the brain was simply a mechanism. That's all there is to it. And if we can understand the mechanism and how it works, then we can understand everything that we need to know about the human mind. Everybody doesn't agree with him. There's an article from the Archives of General Psychiatry from March 1975. And it says, biochemical statements that propose a causal relationship between a chemical event in the brain and a set of observable behaviors where subjective experiences present serious philosophical problems, and I might say also theological problems. The notion of a direct one-to-one relationship between a specific chemical event in the brain and a behavioral syndrome has been discarded in most areas of neurobiology. And then he quotes from Smithies, who says, one can be certain that all reductionist attempts to explain mind in terms of brain chemistry only, or reinforcement schedules only, or computer logic only, or any combination of these will fail. The facts of conscious experience are irreducible and must enter in their own right as basic irreducible elements into any comprehensive account of mind. So everybody doesn't agree in the field with Sagan or others who try to look at the brain simply as a mechanism. In the last 25 years, there have been a number of significant discoveries in regard to chemical and biological changes in the brain which accompany aberrant behavior. I might say that a lot of the study really was helped along by the drug culture. Not that there was anything good in the drug culture, but some of the effects on the human brain by using hallucinogenic drugs and so on really spurred on some of the research on why these things happen, why do people hallucinate and so on under LSD and other things. Of course, there were other avenues too where these things were being pursued. One of the byproducts of the drug culture is the knowledge that certain chemicals alter the brain's function and thereby alter behavior. This has led to extensive experimentation into the chemistry of the brain. The possibilities are strong that psychiatry will turn more and more to pharmacological solutions to human behavioral problems. That's very true today. Most psychiatrists practice what could be called pharmapsychology. That is, they recommend drugs for behavioral problems, and this seems to be gaining more and more popularity over psychotherapy, and more lengthy or time-consuming treatments. So it's not unusual to have someone go to a psychiatrist and immediately they will be put on a number of different drugs. And these drugs attack the central nervous system, the hypothalamus of the brain, and alter brain chemistry, and thereby supposedly alter behavior. In fact, the stage is being set for the ushering in of an era when the possibility of controlling behavior chemically will be a reality, or may become a reality, I should say. All the more reason why Christians must think true the theological implications of pharmacopoeia. In this paper, the subject is limited to what has been learned concerning one of the brain's biogenic amines and the effect of this knowledge that this knowledge has had on altering behaviors, especially depression. So I'm going to just take up one aspect of the subject. And we're going to talk about one chemical in the brain and how that works, and then how certain drugs alter the amount or action of that chemical. There are three principal amines, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. The most important of these, so far as depression is concerned, is norepinephrine. Altering the level of norepinephrine in the neurons of the brain has a significant effect on behavior. Any depressant medication is designed to increase the level of norepinephrine or increase its potential for activity in the neuron and thereby change the behavior from sad to glad. There's a book by that title, From Sad to Glad, which discusses the pharmacopsychology of treating depression. The theological problem presented by this phenomenon is that the sad effect may have been caused by sinful behavior. And the sadness and accompanying discomfort is a judicial consequence of disobedience to a holy God. So in other words, if someone is sad because they are guilty before God, and their depression is really a result of sinful activity, then it becomes an ethical problem to change their mood or change their behavior chemically. So that's part of the problem. I might say that there are lots of problems in this area. I'm just taking up one. I heard another lecture where one psychiatrist talked about the ability that scientists have today of implanting an electrode in the brain of a criminal and then controlling that criminal's behavior from some central point. In other words, sending out signals to the brain of the criminal every time he is tempted to engage in criminal activity, a signal goes out stimulates that electrode and thereby stimulates the brain and changes his behavior from criminal behavior to legal behavior or normal behavior. That presents a lot of problems because if you can control a person's behavior, turning them from sad to glad or turning them from criminal behavior to acceptable behavior, then there's also the potential for controlling people's behavior from doing what God intends that they should do to doing simply what the state or the dictator or whatever might want them to do. And, of course, the possibility, I suppose, looms before the mind that perhaps even the mark on the forehead of those in the kingdom of Antichrist might be a little antenna that would be where messages would be sent out from central headquarters to tell the person what to do or what not to do. There is that potential today, at least to some extent. It's a rather ominous sort of thing. It is difficult not to think of some of the accounts of those who went through long spiritual struggles with conviction of sin before closing with God. What would the result have been if they reached for the Valium, tranquilizer, or the Elavil, an antidepressant drug, to relieve the discomfort? Well, let's go on to discuss norepinephrine and basic brain physiology. There are over 10 billion nerve cells or neurons in the brain. These cells, and a few little illustrations, but these cells look something like this, where you have a cell body, an axon, the dendrites that reach out for other cells. And then this would be the cell body and how the dendrites of an adjoining cell attach to that neuron, and then messages are sent from neuron to neuron through these little synaptic knobs and the dendrites of the adjoining neuron. And well, we'll get to this other later on. So, these cells are capable of transmitting thousands of messages in many different directions in a short span of time. The dendrites sprouting from one end of the neuron attach themselves to the axon or soma of an adjoining neuron. At the end of the axon, there's a bulb-like structure called the synaptic knob. So this is where a lot of the activity takes place, in the synaptic knob, where the message is transmitted across this little opening, the synaptic cleft, which is about 1/50,000th of a millimeter wide. And the message is transmitted chemically from neuron to neuron. And that's why drugs and brain chemistry is so important. Because, for instance, if these processes are overactive, then you have a person who is manic and who is very excitable, and you've heard of people who are manic depressives. Well, in a manic depressive, you have very, very rapid activity, messages being transmitted very rapidly, in some cases all garbled up, and then suddenly the person will go into the depressive state where the messages slow down, and the transmission of impulses through the neurons really becomes very, very slow, and so the person becomes lethargic and disinterested in life, and in some cases even suicidal. So there's a lot of interest in what goes on in the synaptic knob and the chemical processes that take place there. So at the end of the axon, there's a bulb-like structure called the synaptic knob. These knobs appear to cling to the surface of the adjoining neuron, but actually there's a space, this synaptic cleft, between the knob and the surface of the other neuron. This is called a synaptic cleft. It's through this cleft that the messages must be transmitted. An electrical signal from one neuron causes an altering of the ratio of sodium to potassium, and this triggers an electric current that flows down the axon of the preceding neuron toward the branches that terminate the synaptic knob. These chemicals, the potassium and sodium, are usually referred to as electrolytes. So you may have someone that you're talking to, and the doctor may say you have an electrolyte imbalance, or certain diseases or certain problems cause an electrolyte imbalance. For instance, if you starve yourself before you die, you'd probably shake up the electrolyte balance. You might go through a lot of strange behaviors because of the changes in electrolyte balance. We were just talking, too, about how alcohol affects the electrolyte balance. It may cause sodium leakage so that the person, rather than actually being buoyed up by drinking, they become depressed. And it's often because of the leakage of sodium. So when the current reaches the end of the axon, tiny containers or neurotransmitters, move towards the synaptic cleft. So this would be a blow-up of the synaptic knob. So you have the impulse coming down the axon, and then you have these little containers of chemical. And there are some that are stored, and there are some that are active, that are being used. So the little dots inside the container represent the norepinephrine. And the norepinephrine is the biogenic amine, or the transmitter. So these vessels would then go down to the presynaptic membrane on the knob, and when they hit that membrane, they release the norepinephrine, the chemical, into the synaptic cleft, and then it's taken up on the postsynaptic membrane of the adjoining neuron. And so that sends the message chemically from one to the other. And then the same process is repeated here. This would shake up the balance between potassium and sodium, and would send the message down through that neuron to the next neuron. This takes place very, very rapidly. Messages just really fly through the neurons. And so there are millions of messages being sent really every day, or even every hour, through our brains. There are all kinds of messages. There are all kinds of different kinds of neurons, but this is one way in which messages are sent. And when we're talking about depression, pleasure, and pain, and things like that, we're talking about what happens in the central part of the brain, usually called the pleasure center of the brain. And norepinephrine is one of the key transmitters in that place. There have been discovered, and this is rather recent stuff, there have been discovered about 25 different chemicals that are used as transmitters. And the three principal ones I mentioned, serotonin, dopamine, and also norepinephrine. And there are also these mitochondria, which are active in helping to produce the norepinephrine. So the process then is this norepinephrine goes down to the membrane, activates the membrane, and then it's retaken up and reused. And so this is a cyclical action. And if there's any deprivation of the norepinephrine, or the process is slowed down so it's not as active, then the person's behavior changes, so they become depressed. This process of sending messages does not complete the supply of norepinephrine, even if the neuron is extremely active and transmitting many, many messages. The transmitter vessels and the mitochondria do break down and are replaced by new materials which slow down the action of the chromosome of the neuron. The network of nerve fibers in one human brain is so extensive that if these fibers were made into a single thread, the length of that tiny cord would be more than the distance from the Earth to the Moon. So in other words, you have enough of these nerve fibers connected together in your brain that if that was all strung out, if you were really strung out, then you could stretch your brain to the Moon, have direct contact with the man in the Moon. But it's rather amazing when you consider, again, the complexity of the brain that God has created. And it can't really be duplicated by any sophisticated computer. The biogenic amines, which facilitate the transmission of messages along these millions of miles, exist in very minute quantities. The exact amounts present in any active brain cannot be determined without having to destroy the light that allows it to function. So how do people then find out what these chemicals are? Well, the way they do this, they take an animal's brain and they emulsify it. And then through qualitative analysis, they separate the chemicals and isolate these different neurotransmitters. So you can't very well do that to a person's brain unless they're dead. And if they're dead, then a lot of these things break down. So it's very difficult to find out exactly what's going on in the human brain without destroying the light. I might say, too, that one of our graduates, Ed Welch, is doing a lot of advanced work in this whole area. He's doing his PhD in neurology at the University of Utah. And the last I heard about Ed, he had 10 monkeys and with electrodes all over their heads. And he's doing a lot of work right in this whole area of brain physiology. So this is a very, this is sort of a once over lightly, perhaps when I think Ed's coming back in this area, perhaps he could give a follow-up and give us a more up-to-date treatment of what's going on today, some of the problems. There is one way that you can find out about the level of norepinephrine in a person's body, and that's through your analysis. And so because these chemicals break down, a metolivate, some of the chemicals that would result from the breakdown of norepinephrine would be present in urine. So that way you can figure out whether the level was high or low. Much of the research done to determine the quantities of norepinephrine in the brain, as I said before, is done with animals. And some of these experiments are very, very interesting. We'll talk about some of the results. Let's go on to talk about norepinephrine levels in depression. S. Rosenblatt was the first to discover in 1959 that changes in norepinephrine level were related to depression. Subsequent studies have shown that even abnormally rapid nerve stimulation does not deplete the level of norepinephrine, for the resynthesis and rebinding mechanisms can keep up with exceedingly high demands. It was observed that norepinephrine levels could be altered chemically. So the chemical reserpine, which is from snake venom, was used to treat certain problems, mainly hypertension. So they found that by using snake venom, or this derivative of snake venom, reserpine, they could help to bring a person's blood pressure down. But they found that in treating people with this therapy, that many of these patients became depressed. So in an article published in 1965 by William E. Burney and John M. Davis, the depression-inducing effects of therapy are mentioned. In a study, 30 out of 195 patients treated with therapy became depressed. 19 of these improved shortly after the use of the drug was stopped. In other words, it was discovered that the reserpine was causing a deprivation of norepinephrine. Jensen and Fawcett reported 55 cases of depression among those treated with reserpine. Two of these people committed suicide. It became known that the reserpine interfered with the norepinephrine levels in the neurons of the brain, and the reduced level of norepinephrine resulted in symptoms of depression in the subject. Methyl-DOPA also decreases the concentration of norepinephrine in the brain with similar results. So the way that they discovered the relationship between the level of norepinephrine and depression was the fact that they found that these different chemicals caused depression and that they did affect the levels as far as the neurotransmitters are concerned. Experimentation with various drugs showed that the depletion of norepinephrine could be reversed and symptoms alleviated. A number of drugs classified as tricyclics block the uptake of norepinephrine and thereby set more norepinephrine free at the nerve ending. Such drugs are often effective after 1 to 5 weeks of use. So these are some of the antidepressants. And that's the way antidepressants work. You may run into people who are go to the family doctor. In some cases, family doctors, in addition to psychiatrists, recommend things like Elavil, Miltown, things like that. And Miltown would be a tricyclic. But imipramine and a number of other brand names, Tofranil, Elavil, Amitril. These are all antidepressant drugs that work this way by blocking the uptake of norepinephrine. Somehow it works so that as this chemical blocks the uptake, it somehow frees more norepinephrine from the storage areas and causes an increase in the flow of messages. So this kind of antidepressant drug has been used for now a number of years, and its use is increasing as far as treating depression. Another class of drugs known as the MAO inhibitors work by inhibiting one of the pathways for the breakdown of norepinephrine and thereby increase the chemical in the neuron. Specifically, these drugs inhibit the enzyme monoamine oxidase, which is present in the mitochondria. So it's called an MAO inhibitor. And if you want a list of these drugs, I'd be happy to give them to you. But Marplan, Parnate, Nardil, these are all antidepressant drugs which inhibit the intercellular deamination of the norepinephrine. So they work in different ways, but the point is, for us, that these drugs actually alter the chemical processes in the brain. And in altering those processes, they change the person's behavior. Cause and effect and norepinephrine levels. If depression is caused by lowering the NEP level, we'll call it NEP, and can be alleviated by increasing the NEP level chemically, then the whole matter appears rather simple. The right chemistry will assure the right mood. The right mood will give a sense of well-being and a degree of happiness to the person who formerly was in despair. But it's not that simple. There may be a number of reasons why the NEP level decreases. The behavioral cognitive processes at work in a depressed person are the most likely culprits. In an article entitled Overview of Recent Research in Depression, published in 1975, there's a most interesting discussion of the causes of norepinephrine depletion. And I'm going to read a rather lengthy excerpt from that article. I'll not read it all, but I think it's rather interesting. After a careful review of the clinical and experimental, this is the article, quote, after a careful review of the clinical and experimental literature on PCPA, the selective inhibitor, or serotonin synthesis, AMPT, and they have all kinds of these symbols, so we don't have to bother with them. In fact, I think I'll skip some of this because it gets rather technical, and this is really not brain chemistry related to my field. I'm mainly interested in pharmacopsychologists as far as altering behavior. But anyway, MPT and reserpine, these investigators concluded that depletion of brain norepinephrine, dopamine, or serotonin was not sufficient to account for the clinical phenomena of depression. They suggested that, along with chemical changes, one should consider the genetic and constitutional background and the cognitive state of the organism, and the differential ability of the individual to cope with the altered physiological and psychomotor state. Bridges are supposed to handle two-way traffic, whereas in the psychiatric literature, the focus has largely been on behavioral alterations occurring secondary to changes in biogenic amines. In other words, the literature has talked about changing the chemistry and then changing the behavior. But they're saying it's a two-way street. In other words, what they're saying is behavior can change the chemistry, and that's very significant to us. How you behave will change your brain chemistry. In other words, you can bring on depression by your sin, by your sinful activity. And as you bring on depression by sinful activity, you actually change your brain chemistry. Well, that is, one can selectively manipulate social variables and induce major changes in brain amines. And let's skip down to near the end of this. Clearly, the data from all these studies are difficult to reconcile at this point, nor have we attempted to cover all the studies in this area. Nevertheless, there is sufficient empirical support developing from psychochemical work in animals to suggest that a variety of stresses, including separation, can induce changes in biogenic amines, and that any comprehensive theory of depression must take into account this line of work. So they talked about a number of experiments where they would take rats, and you know these experiments where they have a little pedal, and the rat goes over, and he trips the pedal, and he gets a little pellet of food. And so he learns a certain behavior. He learns if he trips the pedal, he gets a little bit of food, so then he may keep going. Now, I saw another in this National Geographic special. They had a very interesting thing where if the rat tripped a certain pedal, he had an electrode in his brain, which was linked to the pleasure center in the rat's brain. So if he would trip this pedal, he would get an emotional high, he would just go crazy. And so what they did, they put a little screen between the rat and this pedal. And the screen was electrified so that the rat across the screen would get shocked. And it was very uncomfortable. But he knew that when he got to the other side, when he tripped that pedal, he would just feel great. And so as a result, he was willing to cross the screen and trip the pedal and get his high. And then he had to turn around, and there was another pedal on the other side, and he had to cross the screen again, go through all this terrible suffering, and then finally he would get his big kick. And of course, all of that was part of this whole behaviorist approach to stimulus response. But another experiment they did was where they, rather than having the rat touch this pedal and get his pellet, they try to frustrate the rat. Sometimes he'd get the pellet of food. Sometimes he'd get a shock. And he never knew what he was going to get. And so they made him go through all kinds of behaviors where everything was all mixed up. First they'd teach him a certain behavior, and then they would frustrate him by not giving him what he expected. So finally, after they did this for a long time, the rat just laid down and gave up. He was depressed. And they found that in that rat, by taking the brains of rats and went through that and emulsifying them, they found that after he was frustrated going through all that behavior, it was actually a depletion of norepinephrine in his brain. In other words, the behavior, the frustrating circumstances, the behavior actually caused him to react, and it was a change in his brain chemistry. You might say, well, so what? Well, so what of it all is that, well, maybe I better wait to get to that later on, but I'll just mention it now in a preliminary way. The so what of it all is, if I alter my brain chemistry by sinful behavior, then is it right for me to run off to the doctor and get a dose of chemical that will bring my brain chemistry back in balance? But really, shouldn't I have to accept and work through the consequences of my bad behavior so that the pain of that bad behavior might encourage me to turn to God in repentance and to seek to do what is right in order to get right with God, and through doing what is right and practicing what is right, I would change my brain chemistry back to what God would be. So that's part of the issue. So, theorists of depression have assumed that some underlying defect in biogenic metabolism was primary. We propose that such a defect, if indeed it does exist, can also be secondary to developmental and interpersonal events. Such secondary biochemical alterations, in their turn, could maintain depressive behaviors via their effects on the neurophysiological mechanisms of reinforcement. So what you're saying is, in other words, you're proposing in this article that it's not simply a matter of these chemicals being depleted and the person becoming depressed. It's a two-way street. It's a bridge that goes two ways. The person has depleted their store of activity of the biogenic alkenes because of the bad behavior. Later in the same article, there is a suggestion that norepinephrine depletion can be part of a cause-and-effect chain that results in a downward plunge in depression. Thus, a vicious cycle of more arousal, more hopelessness, and more evidence of purposeless psychomotor activity. In a system scheme like this, the controversy whether altered catecholamine metabolism is a cause or effect of depression can be easily resolved. Lowering of norepinephrine in the reinforcement system would contribute to functional impairment, whether it is primary or secondary. In other words, norepinephrine depletion can be an effect that in its own right can then serve as a cause in the pathogenic genetic chain of events. So you have then this cause and effect relationship. So a person behaves badly. Because of their bad behavior, maybe they're sad, they're feeling sorry for themselves, they're angry, and so this causes a depletion of the biogenic amines in the brain. So because there is this depletion, they feel worse. And they add to that feeling by more bad behavior. And so you have this cyclical effect where the two things are feeding upon each other. The bad behavior is depleting the brain's amount of amines. The depletion of the amines contributes to the bad feeling. More bad behavior causes more depletion, etc., until the person really is down to a very deep depression. Well, we'll come back to that, but let's just mention a few things about depression and sin. The various behavioral cognitive occasions for depression could be summarized as follows. Anger turned inward would be one. I haven't listed these, but one of us have them. But anger turned inward. These are standard things that most people recognize as causes, or occasions would be better. Causes, not a good descriptive word to use, but occasions. Anger turned inward. Grief, the loss of a loved one. The loss of self-esteem, our sense of worthlessness. Hopelessness, perhaps growing out of frustration. Manipulation of others by taking a sick role. Some people are depressed because they want attention, so they play the sick role. Loss of role status through job loss, divorce, financial reversal, or loss of meaning for existence. So these are some of the standard occasions, not causes, but the cause would be how a person reacts to these circumstances. In analyzing those elements, it is necessary to go a step further to evaluate the moral quality of these attitudes and actions. For instance, anger turned inward is clearly wrong. So if a person causes the depletion of the biogenic amines in the brain because they're angry, And that anger is turned inward, and they're just festering with anger. So this causes an alteration of brain chemistry. Well, the cause is sin. It's not some chemical cause, it's sin. Also, grief, while not originally sinful, can become so if there is the persistent refusal to accept God's sovereign will in the matter. So grief can cause a person to become depressed if they react sinfully to the grief. Also, loss of self-esteem, loss of a sense of worth is significant of neglect of believing the scriptures when they describe human worth in terms of God's creative and redemptive work. It is often accompanied by sinful self-pity and a sinful comparing of oneself with others. If that's the road the person is traveling and that causes this depletion to occur, well then again, the problem is sin. Hopelessness or frustration, the loss of hope is significant of unbelief. Hopelessness growing out of frustration is often significant of an unwillingness to accept God's will. Hebrews 11:6 and other verses. Manipulating others by assuming a sick role to act sad and hopeless in order to get attention or to gain favor from others is deceitful and therefore sinful. So it's not honest behavior, it's deceitful. Again, therefore wrong. Loss of role status. Loss of role status is often a result of sinful behavior. The person who loses their job because of incompetence or laziness and so on, and then they become despairing. Again, the despair may very well be sinful activity. And the loss of meaning for existence. Again, the whole message of the scriptures is the basis for a meaningful existence. The loss of meaning is significant of denying that God exists and denying the redemption he has revealed in Christ. So in other words, you can say that the accepted occasions for depression are really expressions of sinful behavior in most cases. Very often, guilt is a key element in depression. Sinful behavior produces a burden of guilt, which forms the basis for the person feeling hopeless, helpless, or worthless. It's highly possible that such sinful behavior and thinking influences the subject's brain chemistry. In fact, I should change this. It's not highly possible, it does happen. The effect of sin on bodily functions is well documented. Psalm 32, where you have psychosomatic results of sinful behavior. David feeling that his bones were roaring all the day long. His moisture was turned into the drought of summer. The person who continues in sin digs a hole for himself, which is not only spiritual, but physical as well. The problem is how he is to get out of the hole and how he is to get back on high ground where he can go on with his life. Is it right to throw him a pharmacological rope to pull him out of the hole? This is what even some Christian psychiatrists do. Is it right or wrong? In some cases, we will see that it's not an open and shut issue. In some cases, it's a difficult issue to think through. But if a person has been living a sinful, undisciplined life, which is often the case, not always, but often the case with a depressed person, is it right to throw him this rope and say, all right, we'll pull you out of the hole with antidepressant drugs, and then we'll help you walk away? And very often psychiatrists do not do anything more than throw the pharmacological rope. So should drugs be used simply to put him in the mood so he will grasp the rope of biblical counseling? What about that? Well, that doesn't often work that way. Usually people are much more ready to grasp a rope of biblical counseling if they're really down. Once they're back up again, and they reach the status quo, then very often they're resistant to change. They're resistant to advice or counsel. They've got things back together again, so why worry? Why bother? So sometimes you're much more successful with a person who is really down. What's the purpose of feeling bad? Why does God cause us to feel bad? There's a very interesting book that some of you probably have read. It's been around for a little while. A book by Philip Yancey called Where's God When It Hurts. I think it's a good book, helpful in certain ways. And in that book, Philip Yancey discusses the purpose of pain. Now, why do we feel pain? And he points out the fact that pain is really not all bad. There's a lot of good things about him. And he discusses that in the context of discussing leprosy, and how that with a leper, we usually think, at least I used to think, that leprosy caused a person's fingers and toes to fall off. But that's not the case at all. Leprosy doesn't cause the falling off of the extremities. But leprosy simply takes away the feeling in the extremities. So you have no feeling at all on your toes and fingers. And you knock them off. You knock them off with hammers or saws. You might cut them off with knives. And you do that because there's no feeling. And so lepers have no toes and fingers, and sometimes their nose is not there and their ears are not there. Because through the wear and tear of life, because they feel no pain, they simply knock these parts of their body off. And he talks about this man who had an advanced case of leprosy. He didn't have any fingers. He just had a thumb, and he loved to play the guitar. And the great problem was he was wearing his thumb away. And it wouldn't be very long until he couldn't play the guitar anymore because his thumb would be completely gone. And so he then concluded from that that pain is a very good thing. In other words, pain causes us to do something about the source of irritation. And when we feel pain, it is significant of something wrong in the body, in most cases. And so it's like thirst or hunger. The body needs attention. Well, is that also true of psychological pain, guilt, the stress that we feel when we live badly, the discomfort we feel when we live badly? Well, I think myself that psychological pain is very much like physical pain, in that it cries out for attention given to a situation that is causing the pain. And one reason why God has given to us conscience is so that we might feel, that we might be sensitive to what sin does to our lives. So pain is good, and even psychological pain is good if it calls out for change. So guilt is described by some as the worst pain of all. And quite clearly, the discomfort caused by guilt has a good purpose. 2 Corinthians 7:10 speaks of godly sorrow that brings repentance that leads to salvation. For the Christian, similar discomfort is used by God to motivate a person to forsake disobedience, to walk in holiness. Jesus taught that those who mourn are the truly happy people. Matthew 5:4. This is so because the mourning drives the person to forsake sin and pursue righteousness. Bad feeling or discomfort is not evil in itself. It can be a factor for change to a life that pleases God. So what are the dangers of alleviating discomfort chemically? And here we could even talk about aspirin. So we're getting into some areas that are not as easy to work through as it may seem. Depression is often the result of careless, disobedient, undisciplined living. The discomfort accompanying depression drives the person in the direction of seeking help. The kind of help desired is usually the alleviation of the psychic discomfort. The biblical way of alleviating the discomfort, and I might also say the discomfort not only of the person, but the discomfort they're causing to other people who are complaining. Now, the biblical way of alleviating this discomfort is repentance and obedience. To rid oneself of discomfort can be a motivation towards obedience. Certainly the proper motive should be to please God regardless of one's discomfort. Still, the alleviation of discomfort can be a legitimate motivational element. If the discomfort is removed chemically, this may reduce the person's motivation for seeking further help. Thus, the person no longer sees getting out of the hole as urgent because they no longer feel uncomfortable living there. Is it ever right to relieve discomfort chemically? Well, clearly certain drugs are a blessing to humanity. Who would want to go through an operation without an anesthesia, such as sodium pentothal? And though Darvon or similar narcotic agents could be very harmful if taken habitually, they can be a great help to someone who's in great pain. If you've had an abscess tooth or something like that, and you're really, really going through it with pain, well, to take a Darvon every 4 hours might look upon it as being a great blessing from God. And yet on the other hand, you use Darvon, you become addicted to it. So it's not not as easy a situation as you might think. Even the familiar bottle of aspirin can be looked upon as a provision from God by someone suffering from the pain of arthritis or a splitting headache. Much depends on the reason for the application of such drugs. It would certainly be wrong to use a painkiller if the pain was caused by a disease or condition that required immediate attention. In other words, rather than getting the attention, you take the painkiller. So if you have the abscess tooth, you simply take the painkiller and do nothing about the infected tooth. That would be wrong and would be very dangerous. So use of a chemical substance to mask the real problem could be very disastrous. I think that's the issue that we're talking about here, as far as the use of antidepressant drugs. Using a chemical to mask the real problem. Should the pharmacological rope then be thrown to the depressed person? Certainly not, if the taking of antidepressant drugs relieves the symptoms without dealing radically with the cause of the problem. Further, the answer is no, if there can be found a better way. If the person has depleted his brain supply of biogenic amines by sinful living, then a pattern of obedience ought to restore that supply, and it does work that way. That is, if brain physiology can be altered negatively by irresponsible behavior and cognitive patterns in the counselee's life, it should be brought back into balance by responsible behavior and thinking. The objection is raised that often the severely depressed person is difficult to motivate to such activity, and use of the right drug may bring them to the place where they will listen and attempt change. That's suspect, but that's an argument. This, however, can be a two-way street. Sometimes when feelings return to status quo, I've already mentioned this, the counselee is satisfied with progress and may lose interest in working on real change. The need for motivation is another reason why a biblical directed approach is needed. There may be no situations where the use of antidepressant drugs is helpful in hastening the process of restoring normal brain chemistry. However, if chemicals become a substitute in the person's life for repentance from sin and discipline and righteousness, they provide a crutch which may lead to a permanent spiritual lameness. Well, that's pretty much the end of the paper. And this is only one example of the dilemma that's been presented or caused by the use of chemicals and altering behavior. And I really believe that in the future, there will be much more radical applications. That is, the knowledge of brain chemistry advances, and ways to alter behavior through altering brain chemistry advances. We're going to be seeing a lot more radical procedures used. And so I think it's worth looking into as far as ethical and theological problem. Is it right to alter someone's behavior? The behavior, of course, relates very much to sin and righteousness. Is it right to alter behavior chemically? Well, I think I'll stop there. Any questions? Yes?
The Bible speaks about a seared conscience. Now, would that be spoke of the bad behavior bringing on a depression? If a person has a seared conscience, he can't expect any more to, or not very much anymore to enter into any type of depression if he has a seared conscience. Would that be a...
Well, I wouldn't conclude that he couldn't enter into any kind of depression. There are really lots of different kinds of depression. There is depression that's caused directly by physiological changes. Things like hyperthyroidism, other things like that. I wasn't really talking so much about those conditions because they are treated chemically, and they should be, because it really is a chemical imbalance in the body. The thyroid's not working properly. I'm talking mainly about depression that's brought on through bad behavior.
That's what I'm referring to. Also, is a seared conscience towards a certain type of behavior.
Yeah, I think it could work that way. In other words, the kind of person who can go on merely through life living in sin. His conscience is not operating. He's not being smitten by his conscience. He doesn't feel the weight of his guilt. And so it doesn't cause him to go down into depression. He goes on happily. I think there may be something to that.
But in effect, isn't it Roman 1 the same, that God gives them over then to believe that the lies of Yeah. That a person like that would not be at all smitten by his conscience. But it is seared.
Yeah. Would suggest there's something people can do to stop feeling guilt to a certain extent, or at least give some range within which they can operate. But that's going to be the more disastrous in the long run.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Right.
And I think when it, in that passage in Timothy where it talks about catechizing the conscience, he seems to be talking there about the person's rationalization of their guilt. In other words, where they're making up good reasons for their bad behavior. And so they convince themselves, cognitively, they are convinced that what they're doing is okay. And so it doesn't bother them anymore. The conscience, I don't think, should be thought of as a mechanism that's sort of planted in a human mind, but rather it's part of human mind that has to do with moral right and wrong. And so the person simply talks themselves out of the wrong by convincing themselves that they have done well. And that's also true in Romans 1, where they applaud those who do the evil. In other words, they think this is great. And that's exactly really what's happening in our own society today. You know, I've read articles where people are congratulated for divorcing their husband or wife because now they're beginning to come out of themselves and they're beginning to assert their own identity and all this kind of garbage. I suppose some people start to think, you know, why? At last, I'm really beginning to live, and it's right and good. I'm being good to myself. So these good reasons, supposedly, which are not good, for bad behavior. Yes?
Would that be one of the causes, reasons why, you know, there are psychologists, maybe, who prescribe this relativism of behavior and this super positivism you're a good person. It's just relative to your situation and your circumstances. Would this be trying to induce positive behavior, which would also change the chemical imbalance, which would cause them to be, you know, you might say, high on themselves or high on.
The therapist actually aids the process of catechizing the conscience by giving the person good reasons for their bad behavior. And that's it's very true of the Freudian approach to behavior. And even though Freudian psychoanalysis is not very popular today, only about 10% of psychiatrists will do psychoanalysis yet. I just was reading the other night that about 60% of all the therapists are Freudian. Neo-Freudian or Freudian in some way. Probably even a higher percentage are Freudian to a certain extent. And the whole idea is that you do away with guilt, not by confronting the person that the behavior is wrong and getting them to change, but rather you do away with the guilt by telling the person really what they did is not wrong at all. But try to lower their standard. Change their standard of right and wrong. Helping be less inhibited and so on. So I think that would just play into the hands of the whole process of catechizing the conscience. The person is convinced not only from their own mind, but they're convinced by this secular priest who has told them, you're all right, you're okay. And so they go on their way thinking you're okay.
Then they would combine that with the chemical to have an even quicker effect? Or
very possibly.
Longer lasting.
I don't think if the person didn't feel bad, evidently there wouldn't be the depletion of biogenic amine in the brain. So if the person would go along with their brain chemistry intact, doing equal.
What you're saying then is these levels are partially subjective in a sense.
Yeah.
Obviously, it does make a difference in one sphere whether what you're doing is right or wrong. But in this sphere, it's more whether you think it's wrong or think it's right, whether these levels go up and down.
Yeah.
The passage in John 9, I think, perhaps illustrates that, where the Pharisees are trying to figure out a complicated explanation for how Jesus does these miracles, and yet he's bad and they're good. And Jesus, at the end of it, says, I came into this world for judgment, that those who see might be blind, and those who are blind might see. And the Pharisees say, we aren't blind, are we? And he said, well, since you say we see, you're blind. In other words, since you've justified that you're right, in fact, you have blinded yourself, so you can't make the distinction. I think that would make a very strong connection then between a world that justifies the evil and then the person actually searing their conscience or blinding themselves.
That's one reason why in this book by Tweedy, who teaches at Fuller, he wrote a book on the Christian in the couch. And he said in that book that the sickest person of all is the person who has no right relationship with God, and really, though they may have a good relationship with other people, on the surface of things, yet they don't think that there's anything wrong in their lives. They think everything's okay. And so they would be, in the terms of transactional analysis, they would be okay, I'm okay. But they're really not okay. And they don't feel that they're not okay. And so there's no motivation to change. There's no conviction of sin. And so the person who say comes to a pastor for help and he's not right with God, but he really feels bad. He's depressed, or he just really is feeling the weight of the world on his shoulders. That person has some potential for change, because the discomfort, though they may not, on the surface of it, they may not think that the discomfort could be removed by turning to Christ, yet they're open, in many cases, to at least consider the claims of the gospel. Whereas the person who thinks they have it all together, very often is difficult to move. Of course, the Spirit of God is the one that makes conviction. It's not